Welcome to Beach Books and Beyond with me, Monique Chambers. Each week, I invite a different guest from a different walk of life to talk to me about books that they've read, which have influenced them, and books they suggest we take to the beach this summer. You've no excuse not to be well read. Welcome to Beach Books and Beyond with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Benjamin Milton. Now, I know you as a reflexologist.
You do, yes.
So you read parts of the feet.
Oh. I do.
Sorry. But you're obviously a very good reflexologist, really enjoy my time there.
Thank you very much.
And we giggle a lot, but we also talk about some of the books.
We do.
That you read. And you're an avid reader, so I've got you on the show to tell me about some of the stuff and some of your relationship with books.
Okay.
Yeah?
Great.
So tell me, where did you start? Have you always been a reader, or is it just recently?
No, always. At school, really enjoyed reading.
Okay.
But I have to say, I'm terrible with names. I can't remember the name of one particular English teacher I had at 14. Mm-hmm. But I love him for this, and for the rest of my life, I thank him for this. He realised I wasn't enjoying the syllabus.
Ah.
We were doing, you know, the average kind of Pride and Prejudice and Dickens and all the things you do as a young English student growing up in England.
Yeah.
And he could tell I was bored. And he came up to me after the class one day and he said, "I think you might like this." And it was really sort of surreptitious and a bit, you know, under the counter,
brown paper bag.
Yeah, a bit brown paper bag. And I was like, "Oh, what's this?" And he didn't say anything. He just said, "I think you might like this," and walked off. And I opened it and it was A Clockwork Orange by Anton Burgess.
Mm-hmm.
I had no idea what it was about. I'd never heard of Anton Burgess, didn't know anything about it. Vague recollections of a film that had been banned. I knew there were some.
How young are you?
Exactly, I was born 3 years after the film was banned.
Okay, thank you.
So I had a vague recollection of that, but didn't know anything about it. Took it home, tea time with my parents, got it out, and stayed up until about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and finished it.
Okay.
And took it back into school the next day and went, "That was great. What else have you got?"
Oh.
And he was just blown away that I'd read it. And for me, it was a lot of things. It was, a kind of secret language. Have you ever read it?
No, actually,
right.
No.
It's one of those not the easiest book to read. It's written, Anthony Burgess wrote in a particular language. He called it Nadsat.
Okay.
Which is a mixture of kind of Russian and Cockney rhyming slang, all sorts of things. So the opening lines, for example, I think are something like, "There was me, that is Alex, and my three droogs, as we sat in the Corova milk bar making up our rasu docs what to do with the evening." So you had to then try and ascertain what these words meant. And as the book progressed, you did.
Ah.
So you felt like you were part of a sort of secret club.
Okay.
And then the main protagonist is a young boy who's basically a delinquent. So he goes around sexual violence, lots of violence, beating people up, stealing things. He's a really horrible person. But you like him. And I thought that was a genius.
You felt
thing,
sorry for him or something? Or you
No, you like him.
Yeah,
he's really, he listens to Beethoven, he's really into classical music, he's very bright. He has that teenage rebellion thing. And I just thought it was genius that a writer was writing something from the perspective of someone that you liked him, but he had some abhorrent traits. And that just absolutely fascinated me.
Yeah.
So then from that point on, I think I've always been looking back at some of the books I read over the years, I've always been drawn, I think, to slightly darker sides of the human sight. And I genuinely think it comes from that.
That was your first sort of love as a book type
of thing. Yeah, yeah. Just that it blew me away. I know people say it, but it really did blow me away.
Oh.
And I'm really sorry I can't remember his name.
That's
and I'm sure he's not listening,
teacher.
But if he is, thank you. Because he then sort of put me on that path.
And so what did you read after that? Do you remember? Or you?
Funnily enough, nothing. I then read a couple of other Anthony Burgess books, like Enderby's End, and there are a few others that I didn't particularly enjoy, to be honest. Because
quite as radical.
I was expecting Clockwork Orange Part 2. Mm. And interestingly, Anthony Burgess always said he didn't want to be remembered for A Clockwork Orange. He didn't think it was his best book.
Okay.
But he was aware, once it was made into a film by Stanley Kubrick, that it was going to be huge, and he knew he'd be remembered for that. So, ironically, he doesn't think it's his best work. But then I started reading all sorts of horror. I got into Stephen King.
That's so nice. I can't believe you like that stuff.
Well, it's really, this is what I was saying about the dark side of life. It just kind of interested me. But I found them formulaic.
Hmm.
So I would find a genre, say horror, so I'd read Dean Koontz, Stephen King, all these people, And then it got to a point where it was like, oh, okay, that's the beginning, the middle and the end, I know how it's going to end. And it just kind of bored me.
So it wasn't the plot that got you, it wasn't the descriptions of the gory...
No. The imagination, I think, the firing up someone's imagination. And then it was a lot of crime. So like Patricia Cornwell with the case, Scarpetta, I think her name is, the medical examiner. I found those books really interesting, but, and then John Grisham, courtroom dramas. They're all still quite young.
They're
fairly easy reading, but they're not too bad.
The crime.
Yeah, crime, you know, the links to crime and morals and right and wrong. And a lot of the themes that were there in Clockwork Orange about morality and about right and wrong and everything else. But again, I found those quite formulaic. It was just, you know, once you got into them, the crime things, it was like, oh, okay, yeah, I know it's the funny guy that lives downstairs with a limp. It's like, you know, sort of straight away, you could almost at the beginning of the book work out
what was
going to
happen.
I devoured a genre and then left it and never went back to it. So I've never read horror since I was about 15 or 16. Okay. I've never read crime since I was about 16 or 17. And then my friends really influenced me. I just happened to go to a school that was full of very artistic people. My friends have gone on to become quite successful, graphic designers, artists, musicians. And they were all avid readers. And a couple of them had older brothers and sisters that just pointed books in our direction. And then I just completely immersed myself in American counterculture. I became complete. I mean, Jack Kerouac on the Road, I just absolutely adored.
I don't know that one, actually.
You never read it?
No.
Okay. But, I mean, and a lot of them were semi-autobiographical. Jack Kerouac's publishers wouldn't allow him to use his friends and family names.
Okay.
So he just changed the names of everyone, but it's pretty much...
You can see
it's his life. Story, yeah, so. And it's a classic road story in America, you know, a guy going from West Coast to East Coast.
Yeah.
No money. It's the beatnik generation. Yeah. Lots of drugs. He wrote it, apparently, in an amphetamine-induced three-week period where he just sat down and wrote the whole thing in one big... No punctuation, no... paragraphs. No, he just wrote a scroll, basically, and handed it to his publishers and his editors and went, sort of, deal with that. that, again, blew me away, the rhythm of the writing, the, you know. And growing up in the 80s in England, I was obsessed with America, American culture.
Yeah, you know. Everything pop.
Exactly, all that pop music, you know, Madonna,
movies,
Michael Jackson,
yeah.
films, everything. So for me to see where that was coming from, to suddenly start reading Jack Kerouac, and then I started to read Ken Kesey, Tom Wolfe, so, the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, about the Merry Pranksters.
Oh, my word.
Right? Right. Ken Kesey was the guy that wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes.
He wrote it whilst taking LSD, whilst working in a mental asylum. So he was taking LSD. He had trials. He was given LSD as a trial.
Okay.
And was also working in a mental asylum, which is where he wrote, forgive me if any of this is wrong, this is what I've sort of read over the years, where he wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And it, again, that just blew me away. These guys' writings were just incredible. So then Ken Kesey and his friends formed the Merry Pranksters. They had a bus that they painted in psychedelic colours. And they had Kool-Aid, the soft drink in America, and put LSD in it. This was when it was legal.
Okay.
And drove across America having parties and handing out, could you pass the electric Kool-Aid acid test? Could we give you a drink with LSD in it? And are you going to survive? How are you going to deal with it? And they got on this bus and just literally drove across America handing out LSD to everyone. And Tom Wolfe, the writer of Bonfire of the Vanities, the guy that passed away recently, he joined them, and he was a really straight-laced guy, but he just wrote all of their endeavours, and it was great to have one guy amongst them that was sober enough to write it all down. They were all doing it and going wild, and he's writing it down. And I was just like, these guys are mad.
But did he manage to capture the mood and the moments?
Yeah.
Because obviously
a
lot of that stuff is internal, no?
Yes. He caught the frenetic energy of it, which I think carried over from the Beatnik guys, from Kerouac and all of those guys, that fast-paced kind of energy. And the freedom. In all those books, I think the Americana counterculture thing I got into at about 17 was freedom.
Yeah,
for
it's
me,
like a shake-off, isn't
it?
Yeah,
it was shaking off the shackles of sort of grey mundanity. It was, you can do whatever you want to do, that American dream. If you want it, do it. Dream it, you can do it.
Yeah.
You know? Which, again, in England, we don't have. You know?
Yeah, no, it's not part of the...
Oh, no, in England, if you say, you know, I want to be an astronaut, they're like, you can't do that. You'll never do that. You haven't got good enough eyesight.
It's true. There'll always be a negative.
Yeah, there's always a negative. In America, you say, I want to be an astronaut. They go, yeah, man, go for it. You could do that.
Yeah.
Go for it. That'd be great. You'd be really good at that. The Americans are so positive. So, again, I think I fell in love with America really then. So
did it make you go and see America at that time as well? Or did
I didn't go to America until I was much later, actually.
Okay.
But when I did, I mean, I've always been really drawn to San Francisco. I love New York, it's a great city. But for me, San Francisco is just...
The one.
And really interesting, this is skipping forward about a decade or so. But I met someone in London when I was about, not that much longer, about 22, 23. And he said to me, have you ever read Tales of the City by Armistead Maupin?
Mm.
And I'm assuming that you have.
Oh, yes. Yeah, right. Yeah.
And I never had. And he gave me these books. And I think there are six in the whole
set.
Six or seven.
Yeah,
because then he released another one much later, didn't he? So I read all six within a few weeks. I just devoured them.
Yeah.
And just fell in love again with sort of San Francisco and
America. That definitely makes you want to go there and drive up and down those hills.
The first time I went to San Francisco with friends, they thought I was insane because they'd never read any of the books. And I literally stood in this, you'll know this, no, I don't think anyone else will find this reference, but I stood in the Safeway where Mouse and Marianne meet in the first book, and I went, oh my God, this is like the aisle where they met.
And did you go looking for the house?
Yeah, I did. I even remember the address. But my friends were like, it's a supermarket. And I was like, but you don't understand. If Mouse hadn't met Marianne here, these books wouldn't have happened. They happened because of this. So I was in a sort of a genuine supermarket in San Francisco. Like, really. And then I went to a nightclub and I was like boring the bouncers to death after I had a couple of drinks. About, do you think Mouse would have come in here if he was alive today? No, it was hilarious.
I wonder if actually they've cottoned onto it and they've got a webcam in there watching it. They've just recalled, you know, fans of Tales in the City come to relive the Mouse moments, you know. So, yeah, and like, does Barbie Lane really exist?
Yeah, exactly.
They should do that, though. Yeah, they really should.
I mean, I didn't do it now. I don't know if they do them. They any sort of Tales of the City tours or anything. I'm sure they do. The next time I go back, I'll look for them.
Start them, if not.
Yeah, if not, I'll go and start one. But yeah, so Armistead Maupin, I'm a huge fan of. I thought, did you ever read The Night Listener?
I did. That was the very first book of his I'd read, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, so you read
Tales of the City late.
Oh, okay.
And, and in fact, then they came out as audiobooks as
well.
I listened to them in the driving.
Because I think The Night Listener was semi-autobiographical, if I remember rightly.
I think it was as well,
And then it was made into a film, I believe.
I didn't watch that, I think. Because I don't normally like...
No, it's one
or the other for me. I'm not very good at book and then.
Yeah, because
I'm like... No, he doesn't look like that. So I like, no, the bathroom tiles are much prettier. So it doesn't work for me. I'm the same, actually, I have to say.
I have to say.
In general. But any nice books you've
any
read?
Any nice books?
Any nice books?
Well,
fuzzy feeling books.
Fuzzy feeling books. Well, yeah, I mean, for me, fuzzy feelings for me might be really different for everyone else. What makes me feel fuzzy is... But it was really interesting. When I sort of veered off from English authors when I was growing up, because of English literature.
I was going to say, you sort of get drummed into you.
So, you know, I thought Thomas Hardy was dull as dishwater. I hated Dickens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was 17, and I was interested in all these American guys doing crazy things. I came to Malta, and really, I'm not particularly patriotic, as you may know. You know, I don't think I've ever really lovingly talked about England. I don't consider England my home. Malta is definitely my home. But I came here, and initially, I can see this now looking back, because I've been here nearly 10 years, I was a bit homesick.
Mm.
And I started to watch, in the evening on my own, on YouTube, things like Victoria Wood clips and Alan Bennett.
Things that were really comedy, the sense of humour, which is very different in this country,
to English sense of humour. So I was feeling a bit homesick and was reading, was watching all those sorts of things. And then I just picked up a Somerset Maugham book and went, this guy's a genius. And just fell in love. And devoured them. And it just made me feel really at home. There was like Cakes and Ale, The Magician, Moon and Sixpence, Theatre, The Razor's Edge, all of them. I just literally devoured them and just read one after. I didn't read anyone else for about a year. Pretty much read everything I'd ever done. And I just thought, he's possibly the best writer I've ever read.
Again, it's time of life sometimes
time
as
of
well,
life,
and
definitely.
Where you are in the situation.
Everything in context.
Yep.
Absolutely everything in context. Any music you listen to, any film you see, any book you read, any art gallery you go to and you stand in front of a piece of work, it's context, always. And I read Somerset Maugham at kind of 35, whilst I was feeling a bit homesick.
Mm.
And developed a love then for English literature. So started reading Dickens. I picked up Great Expectations again, having not read it since I was at school, and hated it.
I think when you're forced to,
it's
like forced to eat Brussels sprouts.
Now you love Brussels sprouts, you know.
So, but
as
a kid,
bacon and walnuts and
some
really good olive oil. Parmesan and just going to make crusty. Yeah, they're the things you appreciate as you get older. I think you're right.
Yeah.
So for me, they were the warm and fuzzy kind of books. So it was like eating, it was like the, you know, the reading equivalent of eating a scone.
Yeah,
with some,
cream tea.
Yeah, with an ice cream tea.
Yeah,
that kind
Antiques Roadshow.
Yeah,
that,
yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly it. I felt very comforted by Somerset Maugham, particularly.
So they're good ones for the homesick.
Yeah, yeah. Anyone in England feeling a bit homesick. And also, it's a period of history that I really like. So, you know, it's all 1930s.
Yeah.
So I could picture the Hotel Foyers they were talking about. I could picture Paris at that time, the clothes, exactly. For me, it's aesthetically a period of the 20th century history that I really like. So, again, I think that made it even more interesting for me.
That's it, because there is that sort of romanticism about that time as well.
Yeah, definitely. So, everyone looked amazing.
Yeah. You know, can't we go back?
Yeah, for me, and interestingly, when you asked me to do this, I was thinking about the books that I'd read over the years and what I like. And it's always the human experience.
Yeah.
You know, it's the human experience.
Yeah, I'm much more shallow on, you know, relationships and clothes.
Yeah. What else is there to lie?
Frankly, you know. I don't even read about food anymore. That's sort of, you know.
Well, it's really interesting you say, like, I read the feet. I was thinking this as well. I've never read a book about reflexology. Eunice Ingham, who is the mother of reflexology, the woman in America that sort of basically brought it into the West, and she was the one that did the maps that we all use today as reflexologists, has written a book called Stories the Feet Have Told, and a few, Father Campbell and a few people, have written really quite well-known reflexology books. Never
it's not
gone.
I suppose it's a bit Busman's Holiday.
Yeah, I just feel like I do what I do for a living, and I really love it. It's not like it's just a job. But the way I do it is the way I do it. And I just feel like I don't want to read someone else's theories, or I might feel like I'm doing it wrong. Or, you know, and they're not around to ask. You can't send them an email and go, oh, what do you mean by that in page 24? You know? So interesting. I did start, once I became a reflexologist about 13 years ago, I then got into things like Oliver Sacks. Have you ever read of him? The man who mistook his wife for a hat.
Sorry. Yeah. Could have been worse.
Although in this house, it would be quite easy to do.
Ah, thank you. He could have mistook his hat for a wife.
Yeah.
That would have been worse. So what's that about?
That is about, Oliver Sacks was a neuroscientist, sort of working 60s onwards in America. Mm-hmm. He was born in North London and went over to America. And the book is different stories about people, his clients he's worked with. And one was a man who had a visual impairment where he mistook objects. And at one point, and Oliver Sacks wasn't quite sure how much of this he believed, and at one point he went to put his wife on his head. He went to
lift her up.
And he said, oh, it's my wife. And he thought his wife was a hat. He was about to put it on. And Oliver Sacks was like, no, that's your wife. And then he'd worked out that this man had a visual impairment that had been going on for years, but had cleverly got round it by thinking he was a piano teacher. And he had got round it by doing things like people coming into a room. He understood the way they walked.
Okay.
He could hear their movements and say, oh, that's Monique or that's Ben. So he would say hello to them. And for years, people thought he could see properly, but he couldn't. So Oliver Sacks then wrote lots of books. And I found those fascinating. Anything, again, about the human condition, but the brain and how it works. Because reflexology is all about the brain.
Uh-huh.
For me, that became fascinating. Notes on Blindness, John Hull. I think, again, that might be being made into a film. I read it a little while ago. He was a religious education professor at Birmingham University. A very educated man, very intelligent. And he wrote a wonderful diary as he went blind at about 40.
See, that's what I'm biggest fear.
Is it?
Yeah, in fact, I'm so vain that my wardrobe is organised by colour. Right. And
no, that's not vain.
That if I lose my sight...
You know where it is.
I know where everything is, and you're not going to send me out looking like a rainbow.
No.
Seriously, it's deadly serious.
That's hilarious. So if ever you want to break into Minnie's house and freak her out, just go in and move all her dresses
put
around.
The navy blue where the black is. Yeah. No, it's a real thing of mine. I've just had to start wearing glasses, and I just don't like it.
Right, then, I never suggest books to anyone, because everyone has such a personal relationship with books. I genuinely don't ever suggest them. Read, I think it's called Notes on Blindness by John Hull. Because it's just, again, a fascinating... I've often wondered about blindness, about what it must be like. When I was a student, I worked with deaf and blind people. Mm. I worked with people in a care home that had grown up with rubella or something. I meant that as children they were blind. So deaf and blind from childhood. So a lot of them used finger sign, or it was, you know, they couldn't even read Braille. And so I've always been intrigued by that. But this book is the most wonderful exploration into the denial of, no, I'm not going blind. And
so the rest of my house is going to be colour-coordinated too. Finally,
so,
my
husband
says.
We're doing well with Sophie's edition so far. But yeah, it's a really interesting book. But, I know other people that have read it and not liked it.
Yeah.
But
it might freak me out more, but I'll
give it a go. Give it a go, and if it freaks you out, stop it.
Yeah.
But it might calm you, because he really does come to this wonderful sense of calm and acceptance.
Hmm. There you go. Cheer me up. What else?
Well,
what else is a good one that just changed you, right. Affected you, different times of life, new chapter?
Again, looking at something a bit differently, but have you ever read The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Night?
I did. Right, I loved
that. Did you love it?
I loved that. Yeah, I thought it was a bit disturbing because a girlfriend of mine's daughter recommended it to me, and she's like 13.
Well, this is the point. Right, I've never read Harry Potter. Okay, they came out when I was an adult. And to me, I know, we're going to get into an argument here, sorry. I've just never read them. They're not in.
Now you know,
it doesn't think it, but you
didn't know, the first book was amazing.
Yeah, no, and right. I totally, I mean, most of my adult friends read them. But The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Night came out, I think, pretty much as a sort of children's book.
Yeah.
I remember young adults reading it. Yeah. I was working in Waterstones at the time.
Oh,
I was working
there
in the and everyone was raving about it, and I thought, do you know what, I'm going to read this, and it just blew me away.
No, I thought it was absolutely fantastic, and, you know, I sobbed, and I laughed, and I, you know, just felt sorry for this poor kid, and you know, it actually felt in tune with him in many cases, lots of parts of your brain that go off on different days, but I couldn't believe, like, a 13-year-old girl had enjoyed this, and thought, you've got to read this.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
So that's why, absolutely. So it's an avid reader as well, but she really sort of turned me on to it, and now I talk to her about books.
It's the genius of his writing, because you immediately, first person narrative, you're in there.
Yeah.
You're in his brain from the opening scene.
And you can see how things happen and how people create these habits and thought processes and stuff that to everybody else seem completely mad, but we all do our own thing.
Yeah, of course.
We all do our own
thing. And then also, I think makes you a bit more compassionate, because it makes you realise that, you know, if you do see a 15-year-old kid on the tube on his own with a rucksack, you have no idea of what he's gone through to get to there. And it could be that this is his moment.
And just even knowing,
moment.
You know, mental illness, however you want to phrase it, but what somebody's actually going through.
Yeah.
Because you don't realise, people just think, oh, they're doing crazy things, but it's...
Yeah.
The logic behind it, the head chatter that goes on, and whatever, it really, really opens your eyes to it. And I think anyone who's a little bit mean should read it, actually.
No, I agree. Which is interesting that you say that, because I was saying about compassion. It made me definitely look at things a bit differently.
Yeah, no, definitely, because you've all this stuff going on, and,
But no, I loved it. And again, did you see the play? There was a play at the National.
See, that's
like
hard to imagine how they did.
I just thought, again, a bit like American Psycho, I thought there is no way you can turn this into a play. Just no way. And it was incredible.
Okay.
It was absolutely incredible. Okay. You were totally in his world from the beginning. It was staged beautifully. It was really well done.
Because that I can't imagine. I just can't picture it.
It was done in the round. And it was done with a square box on the outside of the stage. Mm-hmm. All of the actors were on stage the entire time. He picked them up when he needed them to enter his story. It was his
really
world.
Really done. Okay.
They created his world on stage and you were just watching it. It was beautifully done.
Maybe it runs.
It was one of the few. I think it might still be on occasionally. It was on in the West End until not that long ago.
Hmm.
So if ever you're back, I recommend that you will love.
Okay.
If you love the book, you'll love it.
Definitely love it.
Which gets me on to my favourite title ever of a book, and I've not read it.
Mm-hmm.
Irvin Welsh. So I read all of his early books when I was that age. You know, I read Trainspotting and Filth and Porno and all those, and I loved them. They were brilliant. I love the fact he writes phonetically.
Yes, okay.
So, you know, at the beginning you're trying to read, and it's kind of Edinburgh Brogue, and you're reading it, and it's written phonetically, so you're like, what is that? And then you say it, and you go, oh, of course. When you say it out loud, you understand the Scottish accent. It's really clever. But he wrote a book called If You Liked School, You'll Love Work. I just thought it's a
brilliant
title.
How brilliant.
The best title ever.
Yeah.
And it's so good that I don't want to read the book, because it can't live up to the title, surely.
Oh, yeah. But did you like school?
No, I hated it.
There you go.
Yeah. And I hated work. Which is why I became self-employed and ended up doing
this. Is a job,
something.
By the way. It doesn't feel like it.
That's what I mean. It's not a job, is it?
No.
They say, you know, it's not a job if you love what you do. It's, you know, and that's why I did what I did. That's why at nearly 30 I became a reflexologist, so that I don't have to work anymore. And I don't feel like I do.
So you can do exactly what you like.
Yeah.
So any other books you want to tell us about?
Yeah, I mean, just now, this stage of my life, I became interested in Buddhism about 10 years ago.
Okay.
And meditating.
Mm-hmm.
So I also now read books about Buddhism. Culturally, if you were growing up in any country, would have been really different. So if you grew up in China or Japan or, Zen Buddhism is really different to Tibetan Buddhism. But what's amazing now with the internet and everything else is that in the West, we aren't reading about Buddhism in a cultural way. We can cherry pick the bits that we either like or agree with or disagree with or say this makes sense, this doesn't. And there are lots of authors, like Joseph Goldstein, who I really love, Philip Moffitt. And these are guys in America who are writing now and saying, this is how Buddhism is today in the West, and it's completely different to Japanese or Tibetan. And it's just as valid. It's not any less valid because it doesn't have 500 years or 1,000 years of cultural history.
And isn't the whole point about it, it's your space?
It's your perception on it. So those books I'm finding really, really interesting. Mm. At the moment, I'm getting better. I try and have two books on the go at any time. I used to have three or four.
Well, if you get your Buddhism mixed up with your pulp fiction, goodness knows what kind of end.
I'm reading American Psycho thinking, this isn't very Buddhist.
Don't feel very calm.
Yeah. But no, so I'm reading a lot of those at the moment, which I'm really, really enjoying. But I try and keep those, I always try and have one on the back burner.
Sort of
There's always something on the back burner that's a bit Buddhist or spiritual, or, you know, in that vein.
To calm you down and...
And to instruct me, because I'm learning about it. These are almost like textbooks, it's kind of learning for me. And then a few autobiographies. I'm halfway through Peter Ustinov's autobiography.
Okay.
Who, I know nothing about him. I vaguely remember him growing up as an English actor, the fat guy who was in a few Agatha Christie's and stuff. His autobiography is just genius.
Yeah.
The guy's, phenomenally bright. So he writes beautifully. And just had this incredible past. Comes from Russian aristocracy. Mm. And, you just would never believe that this actor you saw growing up,
was of that ilk.
I'm
scared to read autobiographies and biographies. Because if I don't like the person, I'm not going to read it.
Yeah,
and if I like the person and I want to read it, I'm scared to be disappointed.
You don't want to be disappointed. Which is why I think it's quite nice to sometimes read about someone that you know
and
you're not that interested
sort of,
in. Peter Ustinov isn't someone I would ever have thought of reading about. But a friend of mine who lives in Helsinki, who's an avid reader, and he's always sending me books in the post, just said to me, I'm going to send you this, Dear Me. Peter Ustinov writes to himself. So the book is called Dear Me, because he's talking to himself throughout the book.
Way.
It's very funny. And my friend Adam said to me, I think you'll love it. It's just so well written. So I went out and bought a copy before he could post it to me. And I'm about halfway through it, and it is brilliant.
Yeah.
It's very, very funny.
Have a look, because I can just remember his face. I don't
That's about all I can. I don't think I've ever seen him in a film. Oh. I can't even remember him as an actor.
Oh.
But it's just great to know that someone, out there in the public entertainment world was that bright.
And that interesting. Because you do have perceptions, actually, and then...
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
But as you say, today I don't think I'd be interested. The people that I like, I wouldn't want to read about. Mm. As you say, just in case there's something...
Yeah, that just turns you off and, you've based a part of your life on it or whatever.
Follow the films
or whatever. Then, I don't like it very much.
Yeah.
But so Roger Moore, I'm never going to read your...
Yeah.
I still love Roger Moore. Anyway, I digress. We have to wrap up, unfortunately. I could stay gossiping with you.
I could too. It's been great. Thank you very much for asking me.
It's been
a real pleasure.
Thank you
to sit and talk to you.
Benjamin Milton with me, Monique Chambers, on this week's Beach Books and Beyond. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for joining me, Monique Chambers, on this week's Beach Books and Beyond. I'd also like to thank Samuel Attard and Carmelo Brett for helping me to produce this programme. Join us again next week for Beach Books and Beyond, here on Campus FM.